Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. It's been going on for 43-plus years. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we sit in front of our radios and teach each other, learn from each other, entertain each other. And I thank you once again for joining me this Sunday night at 8 p.m. when we try and do it all over again. Let me drop for a second, and I will return with the usual links. Okay, I had to do a little tweaking. If you want to contact me via email for either mailbag questions for the Technical Net or to volunteer to do a topic that's in the news or to offer me a TechNet puzzle, or if you want me to poke Paul and ask him to take a look at some space and NASA-related story, you can contact him directly. His email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But if you would like to reach me, I'll give you two email addresses. One is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The other is roy@limartech.net. Also, we offer a link page of interesting articles and YouTubes that I've seen throughout the week. There's a very interesting one on transmission lines and how they seem to work, although it doesn't. It is an obvious and intuitive that you might be interested in. You can get to the link page by typing into your browser either roy.ac2gs.com or links.limartech.net. Either of them will land you there, and it's available 24/7. So you don't have to go there today. You can go there next week, and it'll still be there. We have a chat room. It's been real quiet for the last few months. But if you're so inclined, you might meet someone there, and there's been some lively debate and topics passed back and forth, and comments made. You can get there by typing into your browser chat.ac2gs.com or chat.limartech.net. Both of them will land you there. And as always, I offer an audio stream of this Technical Net that I keep live the rest of the week, so if you're interested in what's going on in Glen Oaks Repeater, but you don't have a handy talkie, type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com or stream.limartech.net, and either of them will land you on the page for the audio stream. And I always like to remind people of MyKC2NJI has a great archive site. It's called amateurradio.tv. It has archives of the Limar Technical Net that go as far back as September of 2006. So avail yourself of the wisdom of many people who have either moved away from the area or unfortunately become silent keys. So those are the links. Let me drop for a second and I'll tell you what I got planned. Okay, I will be asking as per usual for questions or topics for discussion. Preferably amateur radio related, but we'll take any science, technology, questions, comments, topics as the night progresses. But I would appreciate it if you could bundle up the amateur radio related ones up first, because some people get a little tired of the more esoteric aspects of science and technology. That should take us to approximately 10:15. I will turn it over to Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet Report, who will take it to about 11 o'clock, and I will return to tie a bow on everything and wish you well. So that's the plan if all things work out correctly. Anyway, with that in mind, anyone out there with any questions or comments tonight for this episode of the Limar Technical Net?
NT is 8 Echo Alpha Mobile. No questions tonight, just checking in.
Okay, that's very kind of you. Anyone out there with any questions or comments, please? That's grist for the mill. We really don't have much else other than that for the first segment. You don't want to hear monologues from me. So if anyone has any questions or comments or topics that they'd like to hear a discussion or be part of a discussion, please hit that push to talk. Give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2OGB Mobile, yes.
Number 2, Zulu Charlie.
And KB2VHD, Jim.
KB2VHD. Okay. Say again.
KB2VHD. That's probably your alphabet.
Okay, so I have Craig, I have Jim, I have Charlie, I have N2ZC. What's your first name, sir? Nothing heard. Well, we'll start with Craig. What's your question or your topic for tonight, Craig?
Still with Charlie. Name is John.
Very good, John. John recognized. You're second on my list for tonight. Craig, what's your question or comment for tonight?
All right, I got to make this one a little snappy because I'm nearing home. I'm just about to cross over Sunrise from Nichols. So this has kind of been driving me a little nuts on occasion. When it comes to printing, my computer and also my laptop, so if I'm printing out like a photo or text out of Word or something, so I go to print it and it prints normally. However, if I want to print something else or print something again like 10 minutes later, it seems to not want to print. Like, it'll show in the properties that it's trying to print, and then eventually it'll just say it couldn't print, and I'm doing all these things like pausing, restarting, and then canceling all the documents, which does work on almost all of them. However, if I wait long enough, like an hour or two, and then I try to print something again, then it actually will work. But if I try to print, like, more than one thing in such a short time period, unless it's like multiple pages at a time, it just doesn't want to print.
Okay, that's a weird one. Could be a bunch of different things. The first thing I would attempt to do is delete the printer driver that you have installed and make sure that you have a copy of the most recent one. You know, don't rely on Windows to recognize your printer and to give you to download the appropriate printer driver. Go to the manufacturer of the printer and look for it there and download it and install it. What's probably happening, if I had to guess, was printers tend to spool things. They keep things in memory. And if the termination protocols are corrupted, it screws up that process, so it kind of jams the funnel that the printer driver is expecting to receive. So that would be my best guess. Just go to the manufacturer, download the latest version of the driver, and reinstall it, and give it a try. See what happens.
Yeah, I even try to shut down the printer and restart it. I even try to print wired as well directly, and even that doesn't really work. But yeah, like, it'll work on the first thing that I print, and then the second thing I try to print, it just doesn't print right away. Like, eventually it will print after, like, 50 minutes or an hour, like you said, because it, like, stays in the memory, but it just takes forever or just ultimately doesn't want to print at all.
Yeah, like I said, it's most likely a defect in the driver when it comes to storing up, getting ready for the next work cycle, and it has some corrupt ending. So it doesn't reset your printer at the end of a printing session. It just kind of leaves it to dangle, and then other software aspects probably flush the memory after X number of minutes of non-use. So again, you tried all the mechanical things. I think you might have a chance by just deleting and reinstalling the latest, greatest driver that the manufacturer has written. And that hopefully will fix, you know, there's something getting into the spool that's being sent to your printer at the end of its run that's getting in the way of your next printer run. So the driver is the most likely cause for something like that.
Yeah, it could be that. Yeah, I could look into that. I even encouraged the mother, if I could somehow eventually get an office, why don't I just get my own printer and then you could keep yours. Plus, I think we've maybe had it for like 12 or 13 years or something like that. It's like I'm going to have to park out in the street here. Plus, it's President's Day, but I don't want to block anybody in the driveway, so I'll just park right here. Yeah, I'll see if maybe I could try to find the driver. I think it's an HP 910 series or 110 series. It's somewhere around that.
AC2GS. Yeah, Hewlett-Packard is very good about keeping their drivers up to date with new versions of Windows. And one of the dead giveaways that it's probably driver-related is if the rest of the family doesn't have a similar problem, that they're able to send print jobs to the printer one after the other without having to screw around with it. So that would kind of mean it was primarily your computer. And again, the most likely reason why that would happen is there's some unfortunate corruption in the driver software.
Yeah, that could very well be the reason. I'll even bring it up to my brother as well and see what he says. Plus, I actually got to get my taxes to him so I can have him do it for me, because I'm still scared to do them myself. I mean, mistakes do happen, but the last thing I need is to do something by accident, so that's a completely different topic that I'm not going to get into. So let me go inside and see what I can arrange with my brother. So thanks for the help, Roy. AC2GS Net Control, KD2OGB Mobile, and I will be clear. Good night, and happy President's Day.
Good night, Craig, and next week or the week after or whenever you get a chance, pop by and tell us how it all worked out. I did think I heard someone try to mention their call sign. You want to any responses? Anyone else have something else to say?
KD2VHD.
Yes, Jeff.
I claim no expertise on that problem, but I have had it before and similar, and my workaround was hooking my printer up to my router with an Ethernet cable and leaving that blank and having all the devices, cell phones and computers, talk wirelessly to the router, which seems to be able to talk to the printer more readily and bypass those problems in my experience. And I've tried it in a couple of different systems, and it seems to just eliminate all those pooling problems. For what it's worth. I can't swear to why it happens, but it seems to happen for me. Thought that might be helpful.
The problem is the printer is in one room and the router is in another room. I don't feel like running an Ethernet cable all the way across.
Okay, very good. Like I said before, give the driver a try. And Jim, sometimes there's all kinds of ways that printer packets can get corrupted. If you have a lot of problems with your Wi-Fi and such, it could cause things to go bad. But this sort of doesn't sound like it's a Wi-Fi problem as much as it is a driver problem. But we'll see in the future when Craig reports back to us. You know, it's getting to a point with almost no one has one of these, but there's Wi-Fi 7. Wi-Fi 7 runs faster than gigabit Ethernet wiring these days. So there's going to come a time soon that the wireless connection is going to be faster and more effective than the wired one. So another aspect of our brave new world.
More than likely I could, but the router, the plugs for the router and for the phones is downstairs underneath the stairs in the basement, and I don't feel like fiddling with that, especially since the phone has a plug for it that the alarm watches, and if I unplug the phones, the alarm will go off, and I don't want to do that. So let me get out of here and head inside.
82 OGB
Mobile.
Okay, very good. Good luck, Craig. Anyone with any comments about this particular subject before we move on to the next person?
King Bravo 2 Alpha Alpha Paul with a question not pertaining to the printer. Don, Florida.
Okay, I'll put you down on the list. You're fourth or fifth. So I hope you got time to kind of stick around for for the question.
I'm good to 10. I'm good to 10 p.m.
Okay, we should get you long before then. Let's see. Okay, next on our list is John, N2ZC. What's your question or your comment for today, John?
Yeah, first of all, excuse any sloppy transmissions here. On the Echo Link, it seems to have gotten better, but you guys let me know. Second, a belated Happy New Year to everybody on the net. I was up in New York visiting, but no capabilities up there, and just wanted to say Happy New Year. Third is, you brought up this transmission line article, and my question, I'm going to put a little twist on it, would be if you could elaborate on that at all. And I'd really like to hear what it's about, and I'll read the article also, but I'd also like to get your snapshot of what it is.
Okay. I found it a very interesting article, a very interesting video. Sometimes you see these videos where people have, tens of thousands of dollars of expensive equipment, either from work or donated for the cause. This was a relatively simple setup. The most sophisticated piece of technology, I believe, was a relatively inexpensive oscilloscope the young gentleman used. And very simply, what he did was he had a 9-volt transistor battery, and it was connected to two pairs of pieces of wire that were basically twisted pair type of arrangements coming out, but it bifurcated in a Y. So in other words, two wires coming out, one of them goes left, a set of them goes left, and a pair from that branching goes right. So think of it as a Y-shaped wire that branches out in the middle in two opposite directions. At the end of one of the legs of the Y, he shorted. The other legs he left open. So his big question was, what happens to the current? Does the current go down both legs? Does the current know that only one of them is shorted and goes down preferentially the shorted ones? And with an oscilloscope, and also he likes to do wave motion analogy. So he had some water in a tank, and he kind of demonstrated the same type of a concept. But that's the gist of it. It's a pair of wires that branch off in a Y shape, and one end is shorted and the other is open. And what happens to the current? Where does it go?
WB2EAV jumping.
Yes, Ed.
I think the question you're saying is, if you, like, have a split, how does it know that this wire isn't terminated and that one is terminated? The answer is, it finds out in the first few nanoseconds, so it's invisible on an oscilloscope.
Well, not exactly, but as far as I saw from his study, but would you like to tell everyone how it's decided that quickly, under what circumstances?
Well, when you apply the signal, it proceeds at the speed of light adjusted by the velocity factor in the cable, which is basically the speed of light, it's a little slower, proceeds down to the end. If it's terminated perfectly, nothing comes back. If it isn't, something bounces back, and you might have this back and forth, till it achieves stability. So it is, in effect, the system has learned the termination and adjusted accordingly. But that takes, like, a few nanoseconds, and then it's stable. Just a couple of bounces back and forth, unless you're talking about hundreds of thousands of feet of cable.
Well, the way that he jury-rigged it, he had a relatively long length of wire that he just kind of knitted back and forth and back and forth on a wooden frame. So he was able to get something long enough that at a velocity factor, I think about 60%, he was able, he said, to discern with his oscilloscope. But you're quite right. The question that he had for the top of the video was, you know, how it knew which was the short and which was the open, and you mentioned it doesn't. It goes down both ends non-preferentially. It's what happens when it reaches the end that effectively makes a difference. In one, the current is used up. It goes to the short. The other, it reflects back down the line. And so after it reaches equilibrium, the current is going into the short and nothing much is going into the open. But I thought it was a good, I didn't really mean to discuss it tonight because it's more of a visual. And also he presented a very nice wave analogy, a water analogy going down through two channels and the difference between what happened to them, kind of giving you a more visual demonstration of what goes on when it comes to current. And he also thankfully discussed electron drift, which a lot of people who do YouTubes don't bother to do, that current is established, not through the actual movement of a charged particle from one end to the other, because the velocity of electrons going through conductors is relatively very, very, very slow. What some people tend to like to use is the analogy of, you know, a tube filled with either billiard balls or ball bearings, whatever you want for small spheres. And, you know, you push one and another one at the end pops out. So that single ball that you pushed in the beginning isn't the same ball, obviously, that came out the other end, and that's sort of what electron drift is. But I think if anyone has the time to check it out, I think it's a nice demonstration of a concept.
November 2, Zulu Chile.
Yes, John.
Sounds very good. Thank you, and I will check it out. One other question that will be a quickie. One of the things I always found on HF, you might be hearing a QSO going on. And I remember in the old days with CB radio, if you wanted to interject yourself, you would say break, and they would acknowledge the breaker. But I don't think there's any such practice on HF. Is there?
No, to my knowledge, they don't use break. What usually happens, depending upon the individuals and what's going on in the conversation, is people will throw out their call sign. And if the people talking are open to that, we'll recognize the call sign and ask them what they want to say. Or if they're otherwise kind of mindset, they'll make believe they didn't hear it at all. So I don't think there's any equivalent to break. I think it's just throwing out your call sign during a pause in a conversation.
Called Colonel Tact.
That's what I was doing.
KQFYU. The off giving you is it's called Colonel Tact.
All right, thank you again,
Roy. That's the word you say.
AC2GPS, November 2, Zulu Charlie.
Okay, John. George, I guess theoretically people could use the term contact. I don't think I've heard it much on the HF bands per se. Again, generally, most people just kind of throw out their call sign and they hope they get picked up. It sort of depends on where you are and what you're doing. On these nets, I usually advise people to transmit the word comment, and then we kind of pause if we're not busy arguing about something, and we get the comment. So you're right, George. Contact is certainly an acceptable term. I don't think I hear it that frequently anymore. You probably might hear it a lot more than I do.
PD2FIU, Roy, I hear it frequently. That is the term. infused nationally, internationally, or whatever, without of your scope of where you work on radio, but contact, even during nets, even during QOs, is the word used for break on HF.
Okay, I don't remember you using it on the 10-meter net.
I certainly did. But then again, you haven't heard me on 15, 20, you haven't heard me on 40 and 75, and you haven't heard the people I'm talking with on all of those other bands. Contact is the word instead of break. That's it. Throwing call sign is on VHF and UHF.
Oh, boy.
Well, George, okay, whatever, yeah, whatever you find, I'm just telling you what I see. And here.
I'm telling you what I see.
Good, good. Your mileage might vary. What can I tell you, George? Anyway, that's John. Now we move on to Jim, 82VHD. What's your question or topic for discussion tonight, Jim?
Oh, I think I have a pretty non-controversial one to help, I hope, tonight. I was wondering, as I'm learning about HF antennas, I've come to recognize this interesting end-fed half-wave fed by a 49-to-1 transformer. And I was looking for some input, if that sounds like a good way to go, because it would be helpful to me solving some of my geographical issues, you know, in the yard and thereabouts. And I was wondering if it's a viable alternative, or is it a unobtainium chicken feathers kind of thing? Any input would be appreciated. Over to you, Roy.
AC2GS. No, it's very viable. There's a lot of pluses. There's a few minuses, but there's a lot of pluses. It just requires two attachment points, whereas a dipole requires three. And also it's capable, if done right, of multi-band resonances. So it's not bad at all. There are some downsides. It is infamous for producing common mode currents in your shack because it's very easy for reflections to come down in common mode. So the use of a well-spaced and effective RF choke is highly recommended. You should try and keep it relatively high. If you have to slope it, at least have, you know, only one end down. What happens, unfortunately, a lot is people run end-fed half waves really close to the ground, and you get a lot of ground coupling and loss of energy and inefficiencies. And also, get the best 49-to-1 transforming that you can acquire, because a poorly designed 49-to-1 will dissipate a lot of energy at the ballon, and then your efficiencies again falter. So get a good quality, get an overrated, if you can, 49-to-1, because, you know, if it's rated for 100 watts and you put in 110, there are times that you burn out your ballon. But I think it's a good design. It's not the most efficient, but it's a relatively good, simple, multi-band solution, and many people use it for a lot of different reasons.
Interesting. Any particular brand of or design of transformer recommended by anybody? Hopefully something that will handle QRP through a 100-watt radio.
Yeah, I think almost all of the 49-to-1s are kind of designed at a minimum of 100 watts. Anyone out there who has had personal experience with end-fed half-waves, resonant type of end-feds. The non-resident end-fed doesn't use a 49-to-1, it uses a 9-to-1. So anyone with a history of 49-to-1 ballons and end-feds that particularly like their ballon and would rand it to other people, Gosh, silence. I would have thought that there'd be a few people out there who had some history with 49-1s. You know, the problem is, if you buy over-engineered ballons, the only thing that suffers is your credit card. You know, there's no kind of downsize as far as quality is concerned. So you pretty much have to decide on the compromise of how much you're willing to pay and how much engineering overkill you're interested in. You know, obviously, if you buy something that's rated for a kilowatt, you are probably never going to burn out that ballon on a 100 watt, or certainly on a QRP. So, you know, I mean, I would just go for a name brand manufacturer. I think there's Palomar. There's Ballon. I think there is a company actually called Ballon Manufacturing or something. You know, something at the, in the back of QSTs and such. You know, I wouldn't tend to invest in Chinese ballons because quality assurance is real questionable. So, you know, just get a name brand. You pull out your ham radio outlet or your EX Engineering catalogs and thumb through them. And, you know, they usually don't sell cheap stuff. I would not find your ballon in Amazon because they have absolutely, they don't check on anything. We've talked in the past about how fake high-capacity thumb drives that don't really work are sold to this very day via Amazon. They don't really check the third-party people.
KG2RY?
Yes, David.
You know, when you were talking about where to find a good 49-1 ballon, you know, you can just call the 800 number at DX Engineering, and somebody on the other end can advise you, you know, if you have questions, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, you could talk to them. They're very nice. You could email them. They're also nice via email. And, of course, you know, you just take a look through their online catalog, and you'll get a very good idea. They're rather descriptive about the specifications of the different products that they sell. So those are all options. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the feedback. I appreciate it. I'm looking at the ham radio outlet catalog right now as we speak. That was a good idea. Thank you, Roy. I'm back to that.
Okay, very good. Anyone with any other comments before we move on? Okay, someone needs their amplitude really opened up, maybe about 20 decibels. I couldn't even make out a voice. It's a little bit better. You're probably a good 10 decibels below everyone else, but I can at least hear you.
Hey, well, I can hear you, so I'm just standing by enjoying the chat.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Let's see. Let's move on to our next. We're running through people like a hot knife through butter. Charlie, you have a question tonight? Quinn, Charlie, I can't read my scribbled call signs. I think I wrote into UBD or something. I could have gotten a couple of those wrong. Charlie, are you out there? Okay, I guess Charlie stepped away. Next on my list is John, KB2AEGP, via Echolink.
Hi, Roy. KB2AEGP, John. About Florida. Two-part question. One is a query question. I see that they're running that ad on TV down here for, like, internet testing and all that stuff. And then I noticed in the commercial they have a satellite dish in the water. I mean, a big one. I'd like you to comment about that. I think that's a foul way for the closest to the cube up. But it might elaborate on that. And the other one, is there any programs out there that, that can monitor, like, the railroads in New York on a scanner, like, you know, not on a scanner, but maybe through the website? Is anything, has anything ever been developed?
Okay, well, let's go back to the first thing. You said, I think, something about cell phone protection. I hope you're not alluding to, there's a endless scam. The idea that RF is destructive to everyone, and so if you buy this little stick-on thing for only $9.95 or $19.95 or $29.95, they promise to protect you from the radiation effects of your cell phone. Is that what you're alluding to?
No, it looked more or less that they were monitoring ship, you know, ship to shore type, it was a big antenna, big dish, I mean, it was in the water, but, you know, it's like an internet thing, but I was wondering, does a dish like that work underwater? Is it, that just going to protect like submarines and all that, like radar underwater? Is that I know the ships have it, but I didn't know they had it with dishes. That's my question.
Okay. Antennas don't work terribly well underwater, salt water, because it conducts to ground, and then it doesn't radiate. And submarines and such used to use ultra very low frequency. So they ran a long wire in the water, and they were able to get a rather weak signal that propagates through the ocean, and they were able to contact the shore. The problem with ultra-low frequencies is that the amount of information per minute is very low. So you can't really tell anyone much of anything because it takes so long to say anything. I believe that for the most part, Navy kind of has phased that out, and that's sort of why hams have experimental access to the very low frequencies. They have shifted, as far as I know, because a lot of this is need to know, and I'm sure the government doesn't think I need to know any of this, is satellite devices, dishes that submarines will float to the surface and transmit to the satellites, and then they can pull the equipment back down and store it. But you can't really run microwaves through seawater with any efficiency whatsoever. So you can have it sit on top of the ocean. It could be very effective as a very big ground plane, the entire ocean, but you can't really submerge it much.
That answers my question. And then the other question is about the scanner. Is there anything like on the internet to listen to, like, let's say I want to listen to Long Island Railroad up in New York, or something in Florida, or the subway up in New York. Is there anything on the internet that rebroadcast their signals?
Okay, that's a good question. As far as I'm aware, I don't know of any service that does that. That does not mean that there isn't a service that does that. There are a lot of audio streams that have been packaged and sold to people. They still kind of can give you access to fire departments and police departments. Whether there's that much of a demand for those other agencies' signals, and you know, whether they're still doing it analog, I'm not quite sure. I would suggest, you know, as I often say, Google is your friend. Google it, see what's available, see if there's something free first. You might have to pay a premium. I just am unaware. For the most part, guys who kind of run scanners are very interested in listening to fire departments and police. In the old days, we had Andy, may rest in peace, WA2CDL, and I would probably turn to him and ask him if the MTA allows their transmissions to be rebroadcast on internet streams. My guess would be that they don't. I think we're kind of going into a world where unless there's a significant public good for offering those streaming services, especially semi-private agencies are not really driven to open it up. They probably see it as a lose-lose situation. It's not going to gain them anything at best, and it might embarrass them under some circumstances.
Okay, Roy, thank you for answering my question. I'm a trade-off, but I used to love listening to the railroad, and when I lived in Bricktown, I was able to do that to do it by water and line of sight. I used to be able to listen to the subways, the railroads, Metro North, New Haven, Amtrak, all of them, but down here, I'm on the West Coast, there's no railroads down here. I mean, there's a freight that runs down here, but that's very limited, but most of the railroads, Amtrak's on the East Coast, so they really far on the East Coast. All right, thank you very much. King Bravo 2 Alpha Golf Papa. We'll go back to the listening mode, and thank you for the input.
Okay, you're welcome, John, as always. I appreciate your participation. If Craig was still listening, I assumed he's busy doing something else, maybe checking the printer driver, because he works for the train company, and he's a big train buff, so he might know something about transmissions that are streamed on the Internet. Are you still with us out there, Craig? No, I guess not. Oh, well. Let me double-check. Charlie, are you out there? Because I called your name earlier, and we had you on the list, and you didn't respond. So we're giving you another chance. Charlie, if you're out there.
This is Kilo Echo Q Alpha Juliet Uniform. Is that the right Charlie?
Well, as much as I enjoy talking to you, Charlie, I think it was another Charlie, because he said that he had a question. I think he was in November, too.
No, that wasn't me, then. I'm just listening.
Okay, very good, Charlie. I appreciate your listening. We need listeners. We need talkers, too, but we need listeners. So thank you for that. Well, once again, I continue to be Alpha Charlie 2 Gulf Sierra AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the YMR Technical Net. So, young, we've kind of blown through these questions or comments, so we need a few more. So if anyone out there has any questions or comments, please let it rip, hit that push to talk, and give me your first name and your call sign. Oh, my gosh, we're going to have a slow night. You would have thought that last Sunday was going to be a slow night with Super Bowl, but no, we got through it. And, you know, it's President's Day this Monday, but I don't think that too many people, you know, kind of, you know, go on vacation for President's Day. Once again, AC2GS here with the Limark Technical Net. If anyone has any comments or questions or answers, please hit that push to talk.
Roy, Team Bravo 2, I forgot to pop on again. I'll check in next week, and maybe Greg will be on, and we can maybe exchange maybe emails or something, and I can talk to him more or less on email. Back to you, Greg.
Yeah, you could do that. I'm not sure, but I assume that his email address is on QRZ. His call sign's KD2OG, so you might want to look there. But, yeah, he usually comes by at the beginning of our technical mix. Okay, once again, AC2GS here. Roy, this is the Limark Technical Net. I guess everyone is questioned out, but I'll ask again. Anyone has any particular topics of interest or questions or comments to be made, please hit that push to talk.
Yeah, Roy.
Roy,
so how's it doing this evening?
I'm doing fine, Frank. How are you?
Okay, Roy. Yeah, conditions.
Conditions
seemed a little better today than they were yesterday. So hopefully you had some propagation on 10 meters. for your net. Let me see. Yeah, I did actually have a question. I see some DX stations on FT8 using MSHV multi-stream high-volume mode. And I don't know what FT8 mode to respond in. I think if you're using WSJT, the software knows what to use. But the web interface I'm using does not know, but maybe somebody on frequency who uses FT8 knows whether I just respond using regular mode or whether I have to go into join the blight now on the Fox Hound mode. So we'll see if anybody on frequency is enough of a FT8 aficionado to know the answer to that question. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, that's a good question. I wish I had a good answer. My understanding is that, I know that you could use WSJTX. That'll deal with it. I don't know if other interfaces deal with it or how they deal with it. So if anyone out there has some information on that, please share it with us. Gosh, it looks like we don't have too many FT8 aficionados out there. What website are you accessing it through, and why aren't you just using good old Joe's WSJTX?
Yeah, I'm using the web interface through Remote Ham Radio, which uses a web interface to go into FT8. I can supposedly connect WSJTX to it, but I haven't really figured out how to do it because most of the time just using their web interface works quite well. I've worked DXCC plus some on FT8 just using their web interface, which I believe is probably a flavor of the iPad interface for FT8. That's my guess on what it is. Go ahead.
Okay. I mean, there's a lot of people doing similar things. My software that remotely controls my Flex 6700 has an option. I think it cost me $4 or $5 an add-on that has FT8 in it. I haven't used it recently, but played around with it once upon it. Have you investigated the documentation of the software? I would assume that they would have had to deal with that new aspect of FT8 by now.
Yeah, I will ask one of the owners of the network. That's like a duh. I probably should have done that, but you know they kind of expect that. I feel like they expect most of the guys on there are experts. But anyway, it may be in their knowledge base, you're right. And, you know, they use Flex radios, so chances are their interface is either the built-in Flex radio interface or something they've cobbled together that's very similar or linked to it. Go ahead.
Okay. Unfortunately, Flex Radio has this weird problem with software where third-party people are doing much more for the company than the company is. Mine is a part of the 6000 series. It's proprietary, the software, so no third parties have access to it. But the older Flex radios, the 5000, the 3000, the 1500, uses software that's been, the source is available, and there's one particular guy who insanely has been working for free, making it run rings around my radio software. So the same thing seems to be going on with other aspects. As far as I know, Flex itself has no plug-in for FT8. The guy who was able to talk them into letting him use their API to write software for the iPad and the iPhone and such is the guy who implemented the FT8. So you can do it through an iPad. You might even be able to do it through a Mac. I'm not sure exactly who did the Mac version of the software. But my good old Windows PC, no way, Jose. I got to use WSJT-X. So it's possible. Who knows? I mean, he's a very clever guy, so they might have come to some arrangement with this third party to give them access to his code, and it might be running with his. So, you know, the best bet is to go to the source, because only they know how they've implemented things and whether or not things work.
Yeah, very good. Yeah. Many of the expeditions either are using the conventional FH mode or shift to it once they've worked down enough guys to get out of MSHV, and I get to work them then. But I would like to know how to do it. Anyway, yeah, I'll get in touch with them if I can't find it in the knowledge base. Thanks, though. WB2BX, so.
Okay. You're welcome, as always, Frank. FT8 is a fascinating concept. Joe Taylor, a gentleman who won a Nobel Prize in astrophysics. He's a very, very clever guy. And for free, he came up with a lot of these very sophisticated computer algorithms to allow people to do all kinds of things. You could do moon bounce with a fraction of the equipment that the old-timers needed. And he has used variations of the algorithms to do amazing things, his latest and greatest being FT8. It's a contraction of his last name, Taylor, and the other gentleman who worked on it, Frank. So Frank and Taylor, FT, so FT8, and it's always busy. Anytime that I go anywhere near that set of frequencies where FT8 people are trying to play tag and getting as much wallpaper as they can possibly cover their walls with, it's very, very active. So if you've never kind of played around with FT8, go to Joe Taylor's site, download WSJT-X. It's a freebie. As long as you can interface your computer with your radio, it's not that difficult to manage. It's not for everyone, but it's certainly something that I think most hams should at least investigate and know that it's out there and around. So very good, FT8. Anyone with any other questions or comments for tonight? I'm afraid we have that very, 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 very low volume again.
Roy, could you give me that call sign when you get a chance again, John?
Yes, John, what call sign do you want?
You said Greg, his name was?
Yes, it's Craig, C-R-A-I-G, Craig. And it's Kilo Delta 2, Oscar Gamma Bravo.
Okay, very good. Oscar. All right, I had a wrong attitude. All right, Oscar. Thank you.
You are very welcome. Now, once again, we're here tonight. I'm AC2GS. This is the Weimar Technical Net. Anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, hit that push to talk and say your piece.
KG2RY.
Yes, David.
I have a question. I'm kind of curious. You know, there is this radio that has a digital noise reduction. It has 15 different settings for the DNR, and they say that each one is somehow configured with algorithms. You were talking about algorithms in FTA. Do you think that this concept of algorithms is useful for upper and lower sideband? Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, what you have to understand is what's going on is in the, and we sort of kind of touched on that, I think, last week or the week before, that in the old days, the only thing that you could manipulate was in the analog domain. So you had audio frequencies and you had radio frequencies, and the only thing that you had was discrete components. You had capacitors, you had inductors, you had resistors. You had amplifiers, and you had to deal with it in the analog domain. Nowadays, with digital signal processing, and digital signal processing even predates software-defined radios, what would happen is the radio receiver portion would feed the audio into a digitizer. It would reduce it to bits. And then using digital circuitry, it could operate on the audio stream in different ways to eliminate or lessen noise. And I think I talked to Ed. We were talking about something called fast Fourier transform, which is a way of feeding a computer algorithm a spectrum of sound and reducing it back to its separate frequencies, and then you could operate on eliminating portions of that band of frequencies and then reintegrate it into an audio signal and turn it back into an analog and play it out your headphones. And there are other things. There are ways to try and detect for specific types of noises that have certain envelopes and dampening them or eliminating them entirely. So there's an infinite number of rules that can be adjusted and designed in stages to lessen the noises. Some manufacturers, they all keep them secret. And some of the algorithms that are used for the digital sound processing circuits are better than others. So some brands are more capable of dealing with certain noises. So you pretty much, that's the modern day. We're never going to go back to analog signal processing because it's far less powerful. So it's only a matter of using much more sophisticated algorithms, faster processors, and being able to inject artificial intelligence eventually. No doubt at some point in the future you will have noise reduction circuits that actually are able to figure out what people are trying to say and help it along, which will be a kind of interesting, weird, brave new world thing.
QSL, Roy. But, you know, I go back to my question, you know, this idea of SDR using algorithms to pierce through the noise, you know, somehow make the noise less, how did that compare to the algorithms in FTA? In FTA, you know, it travels a lot further with a lot less equipment, with a lot less effort, so go ahead.
Okay. FT8 algorithms are really not terribly closely related to noise reduction systems. It digitizes the signal, and it institutes interesting things. It repeats the signal before it's transmitted, so it's capable of forward error correction, reverse error correction. It has redundancy. I mean, unfortunately, redundancy limits the symbol rate, which is why FT8 runs so slowly. You know, you can get about a half a sentence out in a transmission. That's about all. If you want to, you know, read War and Peace to some guy over some text field of FT8, although I think that's called JS Call, where they put in a completely user-capable text field, It would take you a lifetime to transmit it because of the symbol rate. So FT8 is optimized for transmissions and reception. Noise reduction